Okay, we're going back to church history. Yeah. I think we're on session 7. I think that's where we start. We ended, right? Start at the session 7.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yep.
We're under the rise and fall of the papal hierarchy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Scholasticism. Scholasticism was the attempt to use natural human reason as our fill-in, to deepen the understanding of the doctrines of the faith. It was an attempt to marry Aristotle and Christ. Yeah, it's human reason. Aristotle, most of Aristotle's writings had been lost in the Western world, but they had kept them. Muslim scholars had kept Aristotle's writings, and in the 1100s, now 1000, 1100, a lot of these Muslim writings of the copies of Aristotle came into the West, and so everybody started reading them, and they were fascinated by Aristotle. Some called him a Christian before Christ, his thinking, trying to incorporate Aristotelian thought with Augustinian principles, so the marriage of Christ and Aristotle. And it gets a little crazy. This is the time where theological speculation gets to the point that a very serious dialogue becomes how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? It becomes a serious theological discussion and argument. Because this is what happens when you marry Jesus and Aristotle. It devolves into meaningless, pointless debate over minute areas that have no meaning. Yeah, Manny.
Could you indulge us with a brief explanation of Aristotelian thought and maybe Platonic thought and the distinction?
Plato, they were all disciples of one another. So Socrates started. Plato was his disciple. Socrates didn't write anything down, so some of Plato's writings were probably Socrates. But Plato, primarily we get what we call the Platonic dualism. So he's the main guy that separated the spirit from the natural world. So the Platonic dualism, there's a painting in the Vatican, one of the big murals by a Renaissance artist with Plato and Aristotle walking hand in hand. I think Jesus is in the picture too and some of the saints. But Plato is in this pose. His hand is like this. And Aristotle's pose, his hand is like this. It's pointing down, which sort of captures the difference. Plato's philosophy was a mystical, looking to the heavens. The spirit world is higher. Aristotle, his philosophy is more examining logic and reason. It's about observing and cataloging nature. So you get some of the very beginnings of observation of plant species and various things coming from Aristotle. And so Aristotelian thought is thought about thought, thinking about reasoning, thinking about critical thinking, why we think the way we think. And so it led to these endless debates about theology, really. So you still see some of that today, a big debate about supralapsarianism versus infralapsarianism, which would be a debate in a Calvinistic seminary. It relates to the order of the decrees. It refers to the fall, the lapse, and did God decree man's the nature or the Did God decree before man fell or after? Fine-tuning these little detailed issues that have no practical significance whatsoever. But it's a glorification of the mind and an exaltation of reason. That's what we see in through scholasticism. Yeah, Ferdy.
The only thing that I appreciate about Aristotle is he has educated Alexander the Great, and Alexander the Great went ahead and conquered nations and emphasized and put their Greek philosophies and culture, and because of that it prepared for the right time for Christ to come in so that the gospel can be preached easily.
Thank you, Aristotle. Yeah. Okay, so good point. So that's what scholasticism is, reason. And the church has always had this fascination with Greek thought. I mean, still to this day. Greek thought is humanistic thought. Yep. Greek thought is man starting with reason. And so it's always an appeal to the church. And we always go back to it because it starts with man. Man's the measure of all things. And this is what we see in this period, the scholasticism. Anselm, number two, A-N-S-E-L-M. Anselm, Italian dude, but became the Archbishop of Canterbury. A-N-S-E-L-M. Anselm, yeah. Considered the father of scholasticism. Anselm, he devoted his life to suggesting reasonable arguments for theological propositions. His goal, there's a typo here, unfortunately. His goal was to use reason. Scratch out not. I think you have not in your notes, don't you? My proofreader missed that one. It's my wife. She's a brilliant proofreader, but she didn't understand the theological implications here. His goal was to use reason as a tool to understand what he already believed. So Anselm becomes famous in his attempt to create logical proofs to the existence of God. And you still see this today in certain apologetic books. And if you've delved into any apologetics, they'll have, I think Josh McDowell, doesn't he, in his one of his books, has the proofs of the existence of God. And the problem with the idea of proving is it starts with man's reason, becomes a starting point. It's also based on an erroneous view of the fall, because the Roman church at this time, influenced by Pelagius, they're very, at least semi-Pelagian. So the fall affected man morally, but it didn't affect his mind. The mind of man wasn't corrupted. Therefore, the belief is that lost man could come to the knowledge of God through reason. Well, see, if you had that view of the fall, then certainly you would spend your time trying to create rational proofs. But the whole enterprise is doomed from the beginning because it starts out of a wrong theological premise. A partial depravity rather than total depravity. And but you still see it today. Proofs for the existence of God, the cosmological proof, the evidence from design is a real popular one. Anselm was famous for the ontological proof. Ontology is the study of being. So the ontological proof basically means God is that being that from which you can imagine no one greater than. If we have something like that in our mind, that being must exist. That's kind of the simplified version, but very complicated, logical, Aristotelian sort of premise. Aristotelian logic starts with, if A is true and B is true, then C must be true. So all men are mortal. All Greeks are men. Therefore, all Greeks are mortal. That's an Aristotelian logical premise, you see. So there's these very detailed logical proofs that God exists. But it starts with human reason and not with revelation. Yeah, Rico.
But isn't it obvious, like, you can really prove that God already exists without just having that in the background, just looking at creation and all that? Like what the Bible says, it's obvious.
It's still not a proof, okay? The facts of creation are not a proof of God, and the Bible never tries to make it a proof. it's a proclamation. There's a difference between a proof and a proclamation. You see? So in a proof, you're going to try to explain it so that it makes sense rationally to man. But the gospel never bothers to do that. It proclaims, and that leaves man to the position of faith.
So in other words, without divine revelation, man can never really know that there is a God.
Yeah.
Well, we go back to general revelation. You can certainly know
that there is a God through general revelation.
Yeah, so there's a test, but it's a testimony. It's not a proof.
Yeah.
Because you can clearly look at nature and prove from nature there is no God. I mean, that's the nature of science for the last 200 years.
Was he also the one who wrote the uncaused cause, the unmoved mover?
No, that's Aristotelian.
Okay, there.
Yeah, that's Aristotle. So Aristotle had proofs for God. And it starts with the unmoved mover. So it's kind of a deistic idea that there had to be someone that gave the first push. That person is God. Yeah, so that's Aristotelian. Yeah.
I hope I'm hearing you correctly. You're not saying that apologetics is scholasticism in the modern.
I'm saying that modern apologetics, at least one branch of it,
is influenced by scholasticism.
The evidentialist branch.
Okay.
There's two basic branches of apologetics. Evidentialist, which is the Josh McDowell, where you just give more and more evidences. And of course, that comes out of a scholastic kind of mindset that you can actually prove, and if you just overwhelm them with facts, you can lead a person to faith. It's pretty similar to Anselm's basic idea. And the other category is presuppositional apologetics, which starts from a view of man's fallen nature and examines his presuppositions and challenges him to face the reality of his presupposition. So Francis Schaeffer would be the best example of a presuppositionalist apologist. Tim Keller also incorporates presuppositional apologetics in almost every one of his sermons.
So it seems like they're different more in their, well, they're most different in their perspective of the person they're talking to or their goal. Because like I'm guessing presuppositional apologetics isn't so much to convert the person by the use of your argument, but to bring him to a place.
To despair.
Right. The person will have to look for more, and then that's when
the answer is given.
That's when they find God, yeah.
And I think it goes back to your view of man. Is man totally depraved? And what does total depravity mean? Or can man, does he contribute something to his salvation? Can he think through it? Is he rational? Etc. So, Francis Schaeffer, Keller, others influenced by a Calvinistic view of total depravity, they go to a presuppositional approach. Josh McDowell, others influenced by more of a Wesleyan, Arminian perspective that has some hint of a semi-Pelagian perspective. Man cooperates. Yeah. In that process of salvation, then your apologetic is different. Because you believe if you just overwhelm him with facts, he'll be rational and he'll make the right decision. So that'll be a fascinating discussion. Robert, you're going to love that one when we get. You're already getting ready for that one.
Okay, great. I just wanted to balance that because it seemed like earlier when you were talking about apologetics, like the whole thing is wrong, or the whole thing's a waste of time.
But I think evidentialist apologetics, although there are some place, it always has to be incorporated with a presuppositional view and the right view of man. Or
Like just last night I was talking to my sister-in-law, and she has a lot of questions about things like this. And so I'll give evidences every once in a while, but I'm not trying to reason with her because, like I said, as I told Carla, they're never going to get it.
No.
Like, we would never have gotten it apart from the Holy Spirit. But all we do is plant seeds, make little nudges, and hopefully the seeds that we're planting are causing her to think about what do I really believe? Why do I really believe that? What does it mean for the rest of my life? And then when she's open, then we can preach the gospel to her.
Yeah, that's true. I went to a seminar for apologetics years ago, and I forgot the guy's name, well-known author. And he was advocate. I mean, he started with a proofs for God, total evidentialist approach. And then he mentioned the fact that he had 8 earned PhDs. 8 earned PhDs. Said, yeah, well, that's what you'd have to have, because facts are endless, and you just need more and more facts. So I knew I wasn't even going to get my first earned PhD, so I left the seminar early. Thomas Aquinas, number 3, Thomas Aquinas is the definitive theologian upon whom most of the current Roman Catholic dogma rests to this day. So if you're a follower of Thomas Aquinas, you're a Thomist. Thomist. That's how, T-H-O-M-I-S-T. The H is silent. A Thomist. So it's a follower of Thomas Aquinas. And most of the Roman church is Thomistic. Follower of Aquinas. He shaped the direction of the institutionalized Roman church. To this day, he is the primary formulating voice in modern-day Roman Catholicism. He was. Yeah, he was. Especially the aspects of Augustine that Calvin rejected. So, yeah. Especially the negative things we talked about with Augustine when we got there, yeah. His defense of sacramental regeneration, purgatory, the role of human merit in salvation, contributed greatly to the systematizing of a righteousness of works. So he gave, the thing about Aquinas, one of the most brilliant people who's ever lived. He had, I used to take a class with Dr. George Grant, who may be the smartest person that I've ever met in my life. And he keeps a copy of the complete works of Augustine on his desk for ready reference, Dr. Grant. So he was talking in this class about Aquinas, that he kept 5 secretaries working constantly. He would dictate to 5 his works. Yeah, he's got 5 different people. They're the secretary of his books. And so he's got 5 conversations going at once.
5 different books.
5 books that they're recording that he's giving them dictation, and he's keeping them busy. So he's going from one to another. He's keeping his thoughts in mind. 5 different books, different writings at the same time, and they're writing as fast as they can to keep up with his thoughts. So brilliant man. And so he gave critical support to sacramental regeneration, purgatory, all these things. So Roman Catholic leaders, bishops, archbishops, they're some of the smarter people around. You know, they're not intellectual lightweights. And a lot of it is they've embraced the doctrines of Rome because Thomas gave such an amazing reason, critical, scholarly presentation for these. They can't be denied. So a lot of how things are today in the Philippines, we can thank Thomas Aquinas. Yeah, Robert.
Looking back at what we've studied the last few chapters, it's about Gregory the Great, right? Gregory the Great did most of those things.
Gregory is the administrator.
Yes, administrator. So yeah, that means, can we say that Thomas Aquinas got the whole thing? Okay.
He's the thinker. Gregory's the administrator that makes it happen.
Gotcha.
Yeah, see, those two together. So it takes both, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does, yeah. So our final thought in this is that the church's obsession with intellectual credibility has often led it into grave errors. And I think we've touched on that point. So that's the danger of scholasticism. It's the search for intellectual credibility. And that continually haunts the church. I know, especially in our Western world, where Christianity is seen as for intellectual lightweights, people will, leaders and scholars will embrace erroneous ideas to make the message more palatable. And I mean, there's just some parts about the gospel, it's foolishness to the Greeks. That's the reality. And so we proclaim it like Paul did. We proclaim the cross without apology and boldness. And we know the fools are going to reject it. So, but there'll be some who will hear and be saved. Yeah, Joseph?
Love wins. No, I'm just joking. I think the other side of that, when you said intellectual credibility, when you explained that Aristotle had just come out, and so the church, like if it was today,
it's a new thing.
Yeah,
it's
imagine it would be on the bestseller list. Everybody's raving about this author. Everybody's talking in the university. Have you read Aristotle yet? Oh, you're not into Aristotle. What are you into? And it's great to see that this happened 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Because now, if we encounter it, we don't have to feel insecure. Or it's a new doctrine, a new author, Dan Brown, The Secret, a new movie. Look, the church has faced this for thousands of years, and we're still here. So let's not get caught up with that. And I think the problem here is the idea of intellectual credibility comes from the world. Because, again, because of total depravity, their reasoning is darkened.
Yeah.
So you're going to a child and asking the child, not even a child, a zombie, to justify your existence. When as the church, we're alive.
Yeah.
We're the ones with the mind of Christ. We're the ones. So we don't need to look for them to justify us. And it's that insecurity we have in the church that causes us to embrace falsehood, when if we're just secure in who God is and the fact that He will, you know, prove Himself to be right, we just have to follow Him and preach His word. It will be right. It's not that this isn't a rejection of intellectualism. I think that's just my response. This isn't a time for us to be like, all right, I don't think, I just believe.
Right.
I don't research. I just pray. I just declare. No, we believe and we think at the same time.
Yeah.
But we are not dependent on the world to tell us what to believe or what's really right.
So yeah.
That's it.
Well, Anselm had a saying that was good. He said, I believe in order to understand. I believe in order to understand. So at least in his declaration, he submitted reason to faith.
That's proposition.
It's the opposite of Descartes, yeah. As we'll see as we progress. Yeah, so faith in what God said is the proposition that we start with so that we can understand.
Yeah.
The decline of the medieval church during the Renaissance, papal morals deteriorated, if they could get any worse, and the church became increasingly secular. Increasingly secular. Now, this is all leading up to the Reformation. To understand why the Reformation is the church, the Roman church, just got continually worse and worse. Alexander VI is an interesting fellow. 1492, of course, that's an important date for Americans. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And through 1503, he spent his career in immorality and political intrigue. Now, Alexander was a Borgia. If you know anything about European history, the Borgias are known as the poisoners. Huh? Caesar is his son, his illegitimate son. Yeah. So while Alexander is the Pope, during his time as cardinal and Pope, he had at least 4 illegitimate children to his mistress. One was Caesar Borgia, who becomes a ruler and becomes the person that Machiavelli uses as the example of the perfect, devious political ruler. It's who he wrote about in his famous political tract, The Prince. It's Alexander's illegitimate son. So that's what's happening. It's interesting, though, Alexander is the one who divides the New World. Okay, there's fighting between Portugal and Spain. Who gets what? It's because of Alexander, they speak Portuguese in Brazil. And they speak Spanish everywhere else. Exactly right, yeah. He divided it. Spain, your territory is here. Portugal, your territory is here. So God used him to do that. He's also the one to send the first missionaries to America. And some of the missionaries that went were godly people. He also ordered the execution of the church reformer, Savonarola. Interesting fella. You can read all about him in one of my favorite books called The Bad Popes. It's a thick book. Julius II. Unfortunately, Julius is not here with us to enjoy his moment here. Julius II was, he followed after Alexander, politician and warrior who spent his papacy in military campaigns. So there are paintings of him on big white horses leading the army in battle to go kill people to get more land for the Vatican, called the Papal States. So that's Julius. He also was, of course, he had illegitimate children, spent a lot of the Vatican money on Renaissance painting and art, etc. That leads us to Leo the X. Leo the X, notice his dates, 1513 to 1521. Important, so that encompasses Luther's 95 Theses and the Diet of Worms. He took more of an interest in the revival of pagan literature and art than in religion. Here's a quote from the book, The Bad Popes. So strong was Leo's love of classical scholarship that it seemed to many that he cherished profane literature at the cost of the scriptures, absorbing the skepticism of the humanists as well as their learning. How very profitable this fable of Christ has been to us through the ages, he remarked lightly to a companion after the latter had quoted from the Gospels. He also, after he assumed office as the Pope, he wrote a letter to his brother and he said, God has given us the papacy. Let us enjoy it. Now, these things were not going unnoticed by the average person. So, I mean, there wasn't the Inquirer or the internet, but you couldn't do these things and not be known. Which is leading to number two, a fierce anti-clericalism. Anti-clericalism, A-N-T-I. C-L-E-R-I-C-A-L-I-S-M. Anti-clericalism is basically a hatred of church leaders. Church leaders, yeah. It's pretty common in the West, especially in the media. So most times when you see a minister represented in media, it's a negative context. I can't remember this movie. I saw Jack Nicholson and Robin. What's her name, the girl that was in?
Robin
Penn Warren, yeah. She was in that. It's a murder mystery. And I remember the whole premise was based, there was a clergy there. He's not the person who did it. But that's the twist at the end. It's not here. But it's not him. The whole premise is that everybody is going to automatically think it's going to be him, because the mindset that is so predominant in Western media is that ministers are always evil, bad, out for their own. So in this one, the twist was, it wasn't the minister. That's the twist, you see. That's how far anti-clericalism has gone, you see. And of course, you know, the Western media is hugely influencing the Philippines. So during this period, here's what's happening. Because news is getting out. Now, you got this thing called the Babylonian captivity. This is when the papacy was basically kidnapped and taken to France, Avignon. So you've got there's no more popes in Rome now for almost 70 years. They're in France. Avignon. And then when it finally comes to the end in 1778, there's this huge schism, and they kidnap this pope and all this intrigue. And in the end, they set up a pope in Rome and a pope in Avignon. So it's like the two towers. You got Saruman versus Sauron, and they're at war against each other. And this goes on for a number of years. Finally, they meet in the Council of Constance in 1414, and they depose both of those popes and put a third one in office in another place. But those other two, they won't resign. So now we got three popes vying for the allegiance of others. And of course, what pope do I follow? So not only you got an anti-pope, you got an anti-anti-pope and an anti-anti-anti-pope. And finally, they kick all of them out, and everybody agrees they all have to go. And they put this guy, Martin the Fifth, I think, or Sixth, and they clear out this whole issue. But this is causing huge uproar. Who can we trust? The church is they just not viable anymore at all. Really, God's exposing the corruption for the world to see in preparation for what amounts to a worldwide revival in the Protestant Reformation. Also, number three, the rise of nationalism. Nationalism fueled the desire for self-determination and the removal of papal interference. So what happens is these nations begin to get some kind of sense of identity. And now they've got a foreign power dictating how they run their civil government. And as the nations begin to get a sense of identity, and the people in these nations begin for the first time thinking of themselves as French, not citizens of the papacy, then they begin to lean towards their own ruler as opposed to the Pope. So this is another preparation for the Protestant Reformation. All right, thoughts, comments, questions? Forerunners of the Reformation. Okay, we've had a lot of bad news. The news is going to start to get a little better now. John Wycliffe. Wycliffe. Although there are so many different ways to spell his name, I could never get it, grade it wrong on a test. You can spell it. I've seen it 7-8 different ways. So as long as you start with a W and got a Y and a C in there, some combination of the letters, it'll be close. Notice the dates, 1330, 1384. So still, 1517, we're still a long way, 140 years before Martin Luther, produced the first complete translation of the Bible into English. Now, we don't understand the concept, but this is a radical gesture. Not only spiritually, but politically. And it's going to cause tremendous turmoil. Actually leads to one of the famous events in English history, 1383, is the peasant revolt. So there's this major uprising of the peasants, and one of the leaders was a guy named John Ball, who was one of Wycliffe's preachers, disciples. And so what they're doing, they're putting the scriptures in the hands of the common people who can read it in their own language. And you start getting people reading the Bible, they start realizing, I don't have to live this way anymore. I don't have to take this. And, of course, it's a misguided attempt on the part of the peasants. And it has some ramifications in that it causes the governments to clam up and to be a little bit more suspicious about these reform movements, as we're going to see when we get to Luther. But here, he's the morning star of the Reformation. Here's the beginning of the priesthood of the believer. And he taught that the Bible is the only rule of faith. He said the popes have erred And he actually said they might even be the Antichrist. Yeah. He said that the popes are not infallible. And here's his bold statement. Christ, not the Pope, is the head of the church. So the people that began to follow him, he got his own group. They're called Lollards. Lollards, L-O-L-L-A-R-D-S. A Lollard is someone who's lazy. Because what happened is people got affected by the gospel, and it produced lay preachers. So people couldn't get ordained by the Roman church, but they were filled with the gospel. So people started going around and having open-air meetings and preaching the gospel. That means they didn't work. That means they got paid from tithes and offerings and support and various things. So they called them Lollards.
Just like us.
Essentially. Essentially. But, again, and this happens throughout history, what starts as a derogatory term actually becomes the term that the movement itself takes on. Methodism is another example of that. So they're called the Lollards, and there's preaching going all over England and missionaries being sent out. Wycliffe taught that the Bible was the sole authority for the believer and that Christ, not the Pope, is the head of the church. He condemned many of the doctrines of the Roman church. So guess what the Pope did to him? Condemned him and commanded him to be taken as a heretic and burned at the stake. But there's a problem. The Pope is French at this time. Do you understand the relationship between the French and the English? They've been going at it for about 800 years. And they still just tolerate one another. But they don't like each other. And they certainly didn't. And so here we got nationalism. It's a French pope that's saying, we command you, give him up to be burned at the stake. Well, the English rulers, they want to burn him at the stake. But they don't want to obey the French pope. So they say no, and they take a stand against him, and he lives out his life. But then, as soon as, after the Council of Constance, when the papacy is restored, 44 years later, they dig up his bones. They have a trial of Wycliffe. They try him, and they burn his bones at the stake 44 years later. Because now it's a pope not from France. Spirit is gone. Exactly. I'm so happy you're learning so much. Oh my gosh, I can tell. All right, we're getting close to lunch here. Hold on a few more minutes. Number two, Jan Hus, H-U-S-S. Jan Hus. It should be pronounced Jan. Yeah, but you can say John, you can say Jan. You can say whatever. He was condemned, or he condemned the abuses of the church, burned at the stake. In the Fox's Book of Martyr, it records his trial. It says, when the wood was piled up to his very neck, the Duke of Bavaria was so officious as to desire him to recant. But Hus said, no, I never preached any doctrine of an evil tendency. And what I taught with my lips, I now seal with my blood. Wow. Now, from Hus, the church that he started, the Hussite church, eventually, these are Moravians, you see. And so in the 1700s, this same church is going to be led by Count Zinzendorf. Wow. And they're going to begin the Moravian movement, which they start a 100-year prayer meeting. You know, they prayed nonstop, consecutively for 100 years. And they send missionaries into all of the world, all from Jan Hus. It was his church that he started. And these are the Moravians. So, it's a powerful legacy. Desiderius Erasmus.
What nationality was Jan Hus again?
They're, well, Moravians. So it's a... No, Hungarian. It's Hungarian, yeah. Desiderius Erasmus, Erasmus, greatest humanist scholar of the Northern Renaissance, challenged many church practices. He ridiculed the Roman church, their superstitions, relics. He wrote a book in praise of folly, which was a bestseller. Actually, he initially supported Luther, but then when Luther broke with the church, then he denounced him. Erasmus and Luther's writings were so predominant that during that period when they were alive and after, it's estimated that one out of every six books that was being published in Europe was either from Luther or Erasmus.
Wow.
16% of all the books were coming from those two guys alone. And then Gutenberg, we'll conclude with him, and then we're going to get a class picture. If I can, I got to tell you this first. Johann Gutenberg, G-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, opened the door for the rapid dissemination of knowledge through his printing press. He also inadvertently undermined the authority of the Roman Church, which had controlled the distribution of knowledge for many centuries. You understand, if you have a totalitarian regime, you have to control the dissemination of knowledge. And so the Roman Church had, but now you get these printing presses, and there's a free exchange of ideas. And totalitarian regimes, they tumble when information begins to get disseminated. That's, of course, when you go to China, why internet has to be severely blocked. Because if the free exchange of idea begins, they will no longer have a job for very long. We got to conclude because we got to take a picture, apparently. So, Carlos, you want to lead us?